to call the meeting to order. Scare everyone.
Now, Kim.
Yep. Thank you.
Kim, be nice to us.
We'd like to call the meeting to order Wednesday, March 26th. This is the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. I'd like to make a couple announcements. We are looking for, just as a reminder, to tell folks that any amendments to House File 2150 are due to the committee administrator by 3 p.m. today. If you have any questions or problems, she's available to take those calls or emails or drop by her office. And they'll all be posted after 3 on the website, any amendments that are received.
Madam.
Tomorrow, we're going to hear the amendments at the committee meeting, and we're going to mark up the bill. So just want to remind you that we may have to go into the evening to finish that markup, so just keep your calendars open and watch your emails for further information. We are going to today take public comment on the bill that we heard yesterday. We just walked through it formally yesterday, and so today's the opportunity for public comment before we move to the amendments tomorrow. So, Representative Grunhagen, did you have a question or comment before we get started?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, on an omnibus bill, you can bring, it doesn't have to necessarily be a finance amendment, correct?
I believe the leadership has told us that this should be a finance bill, and that policy needs to go and should have gone to the Health and Human Service Policy Committee. And I don't know how strict they've been, but in the past, when we've had policy show up in those finance bills and it goes to the floor, we've had criticism. So I think they would prefer it to only be have a financial component.
Okay.
So,
Madam Chair?
Representative Dean.
I believe the committee has its own rules on germaneness, as custom and usage has not been enforced in the finance committees that I've been a part of. So I don't know if there's been a rule change within the committee, but we should probably address that with Representative Abler if there is a change ahead of time. Thanks.
Thank you. I just want to make sure we have... I don't want amendments to come on and have them come off in ways and means because they're not relevant. So I'm just raising that issue, and Representative Liebling has an omnibus bill that perhaps would be more appropriate to amend things on the House floor or at whatever other time. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think for those of us who care about this complex area of policy, it actually serves your interest better if it's in one of the other bills, I think, because my understanding is that this will be conferred as one supplementary budget bill. And so most of the conferees will not know what these provisions are involving that are complicated policy provisions. And so that's another strategy thing for you to think about.
You bet. Okay, so we're going to move forward. I do have a list of folks who would like to testify on House File 2150. So to those testifiers, we'd like to ask you to keep your comments to 3 to 4 minutes each. We have a long list of people who have come to testify. So we are going to kind of watch the time, and if it starts getting too long, we may remind you of that time limit. And the first person on the list today is Dr. Alan Goldblum. You come to the table and identify yourself for the record before you start your testimony. I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning to you and to members of the committee. My name is Alan Goldblum. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, and I'm accompanied today by Alec Mahmood, who is the Chief Financial Officer of Children's and is here to answer any technical or financial questions if you should have them. Children's is the state's largest freestanding pediatric facility, serving children from every county in the state, with almost half of our beds being intensive care, and the level of acuity is very, very high. We have the fourth largest neonatal intensive care unit and sixth busiest pediatric emergency department in the country. And with 45% of our patients reliant on Medicaid, we couldn't have become a state and nation leader without help from you. So thank you for your commitment to our state's most vulnerable population, our children. The rebasing of Medicaid rates is much needed and long overdue, but the change to a single standardized Medicaid rate is problematic for children's and could have a devastating impact on our institution. We know from past experience that the legislature has tried to hold pediatrics harmless, but a change to a single rate for all hospitals could reverse those good intentions. Not all hospitals are similar in population or in the services that they provide. Children's is uniquely different, with distinctly different resources and funding structures. We do understand the need to streamline and simplify, but we want to ensure that in an effort to pursue efficiencies, we don't jeopardize our critical safety net and specialty hospitals. In theory, the move to the APR-DRG system should help pediatrics because it allows for more pediatric-specific diagnostic codes. But if those rates are applied, if the rates that are applied to those codes are less than the current rates, it would negatively affect the reimbursement that we receive. Now, the good news is that there is precedent for acknowledging pediatrics in other states. Navigant, which is the consulting firm working with the Department of Human Services on this project, has also worked to protect pediatrics and children's hospitals in four other states: California, Texas, Illinois, and Ohio. So we know that this can be done. The question is going to be how. We were encouraged to hear that the Department of Human Services recognizes pediatrics as a unique population and one that needs to be looked at more closely. And we look forward to working with them and with you as we move through this time of uncertainty. We'll be watching this process closely and are more than happy to be helpful in whatever way we can. And we appreciate the opportunity to share this with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative
Fabler. Well, thanks, and I appreciate you bringing those concerns forward, Dr. Goldblum. And I'm concerned about that whole thing too. And I had some meetings with the department, and you know, life is moving on, and all the ICD-10s, and I mean, it's like it just could be the perfect storm happening on October 1st, and the other times that are, and we won't be in session then, and. And so are you going to propose an amendment to the bill that I'd be happy to carry, or is that already in process as the process moves along?
Representative Aber, thank you, Madam Chairman. Our understanding is that the department is already beginning to work on this. What we're concerned about is the uncertainty about the direction in which they're going to move, and how specifically they're going to address the issue. The initial concern we had was this idea of going to a single blended rate, which we think would be disastrous. We're not sure yet, and we're trying to get better information before knowing whether we have to propose something more specific in terms of amendment. I'd also turn to my CFO, Alec Mahmood, to see if he has anything more specific to say on this.
Mr. Mahmood?
Yes, thank you. The situation as it sits today with the carve-out for children's and pediatric care works well. If there were to be any adjustment along those lines, a move to compensating the hospitals that have a higher percentage of disproportionate share of the dish, I think would be the ideal situation. And really, that's what we should be targeting, is actually those who have Medicaid and have fewer means, rather than a pediatric carve-out. I think that would be the ideal situation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
So, I mean, this bill has a ways to go. There's, you know, ways and means and the floor, and then a process through the conference. And I know that it's on our mind, and you probably don't need something for Friday or for Thursday unless you want just a placeholder somehow. But I think it wouldn't be bad to show the will of the committee that we don't want to cause harm, and frankly the department needs our leadership sometimes to say no, we're not doing that, and what happens sometimes is they do something and then we have to pick up the pieces after you tried to suffer the harm. So one thing else, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, Dr. Goldblum has been a real asset to our state, and I understand he's about to do something else with his life. And I mean, a lot of people on this committee haven't got to know him, but he's one of the examples why Minnesota is the leader it is in both pediatric work and in healthcare. And men like him don't come around every day, and so I wanted to acknowledge his great contributions to the many roles he shared in his time, and wish him the best as he. Maybe he'll stick around a little longer, but I think you're probably going to do what you're going to do. But so I just want to commend him for his work and for his leadership.
Thank you. And Dr. Goldblum, I think on behalf of all of us on the committee, we thank you for your dedication and work over the years and wish you the best if you choose to.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Abler. Those are very kind words. I appreciate it.
Thank you. If there's no other questions, I don't see any other hands. Thank you for your testimony, and we'll give that due consideration. And we do have, and perhaps I will list not only who's up, but who's going to be next in line. We have Barbara Jors with Gillette, followed by Carolyn Wilson from Fairview.
Good morning.
Good morning. If you'd say your name into the mic prior to your testimony, that will help us.
So, good morning. I am Barbara Jors, the new CEO and president for Gillette Children's Specialty Care in St. Paul. And with me is Jim Hadigan, our chief financial officer, who has been with the organization over 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Thank you. Representative Norton, members, and to the gallery, thank you for inviting us to talk today. In light of what Children's of Minnesota represented, we'll be able to truncate our statements, and I think the questions would be in the same line that we just heard. So I will truncate down to the point that Dr. Goldblum brought. Every hospital is very different, and so with that, on Gillette, I will focus on how we are different and the impact, as written, this bill would impact us. Gillette is a pediatric hospital that is also highly acute, similar to Children's of Minnesota. We treat trauma, inpatient rehabilitation, and other treatments that are focused and specific on short-term and long-term disabilities. We serve patients from every single county of the state. I believe we gave you a map. And people travel to us as well as we travel out to them with our outreach clinics. 58% of our children and our young adults are eligible for medical assistance. That's one of the highest rates, I believe, being new to the state. We serve this population. We do not cover our costs. Medical assistant fee for service reimbursements represents to Gillette 44 cents on the dollar of our cost. That's not our charge, which is often confused. PMAT reimburses us at the 65 cent rate. Long term, we already know this isn't viable, and Gillette is making moves to improve that business model. The patients we serve with medical complex conditions are not simply in and out of the hospital with a one-time stay. Many of our children receive multiple surgeries over the course of their life. Continuity of care is the best that we can give them for medical outcomes and lifetime achievement. As a pediatric hospital, we see that our patients are considered, even at the federal level, some of the most acute in the nation. The acuity of our patients in comparison to other children's hospitals, independent and part of systems, is one of the highest in the nation and in the area. We are concerned that with the upcoming rebasing process, because the complexity of our patient population and the cost associated with delivering outcomes for this population, if brought down to a statewide average, it would harm Gillette severely. If you picture a bell curve, all of our patients are to the right for complexity and for cost of care. Bringing us down to the state average, we would have to make hard decisions. And while the APR DRGs will offset some of that, it would not recoup what an average would do to Gillette. We do recognize and appreciate the department and others around the table discussing a possible amendment to help designate a package to not do severe harm in 1 year. But please note that 3%, even a 3% reduction for Gillette would remain in our eyes, we would have to cut labor and change access to our care. We run thin margins and we're not highly capitalized, and with that there would be tough decisions. Access to chronic and complex kids are our focus, and so we want to thank you for your attention to this, and if you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any new comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I'll just kind of piggyback on what Representative Abler said before and with what Dr. Goldblum testified to and then what the testifier testified to. The reality is these hospitals that treat this population are really treating the far end of one spectrum as their main everyday patient, and then providing a vast array of services within a hospital, whether it's the family specialists and the different clinicians and the support staff that helps not only the patient child but the entire family go through that kind of traumatic process of being treated for a chronic illness. And so I think when you look at that breadth of service compared to many of our other fine hospitals, you can see that there's a distinct operational difference here that we have to do anything we can try to help preserve.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Zerwas. I don't see any other questions, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We appreciate that very much. And are we good?
Thank you.
Members, we had Ann Berry on the list next to testify with DHS, but instead there is a letter that has been drafted and you have in your packets. If you have any questions, she is willing to answer those questions. If not, we can come back to those later. I don't see anyone with questions right now, so you can look that over and bring those questions forward later in the hour. Carolyn Wilson and then Melinda Hugdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Carolyn Wilson. I serve as Fairview's Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer, and President of the University of Minnesota Medical Center. I want to, like Children's and Gillette, thank you for your commitment to children's health care. We are together the state of the art for the country. I also want to thank you for including us in the omnibus budget bill and fixing the 10% rate reduction for the University of Minnesota Children's Hospital. Each day, our hospital treats thousands of Minnesotans, and we are the state's largest provider of behavioral health care, including for children and Medicaid services. In 2011, we brought together all of our children's services into our single location when we opened the University of Minnesota Children's Hospital. State-of-the-art facility has 267 beds. Through our affiliation with the University of Minnesota Medical School, our patients and families have access to the latest medical breakthroughs. We're also proud of our commitment to the future of medicine. We are one of the nation's top 20 pediatric research programs. Our doctors apply innovative approaches to creating medical breakthroughs based on their work with patients and on findings through research at the University of Minnesota. It's led to several firsts, including in solid organ transplant and blood and marrow transplant. We're also very committed to the future of pediatric medicine. In our educational efforts, we offer a large pediatric residency program, training more pediatricians than any other children's hospital in Minnesota. Last year alone, we hosted 40 medical pediatric residents and 71 pediatric residents. The pediatricians we train mostly stay and practice in Minnesota, ensuring we have highly trained doctors for the future generations of Minnesotan children. We take our threefold mission of clinical care, research, and education very seriously, and are proud of the impact we have on this state. So, Chair and committee members, given the significant children's health care services provided by the University of Minnesota Children's Hospital, I want to again thank you for allowing us to be part of your bill.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions? Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I want this to come out as nicely as I can say it. This is the kind of testimony that I sat there in 2011 and heard 3 years ago, and it's a different time. And we can discuss whether it was a good idea to raise taxes or not, but we did, and there's money in the till. And it's really important that these finest critical hospitals serving this population don't come to harm because of some technical work that we do. and so we would hope in times that they actually could get rate increases that resemble inflation and so on, but they're just worried about not getting reduced. And so I'm sure the department is listening to this conversation, but as this goes forward, it's really important that unintended consequences don't happen. And I do think, Madam Chair, that we should conjure up just some kind of an amendment for tomorrow, just to make it clear this committee would be unanimously supported, that we would just make sure that the harm that they fear doesn't happen, even inadvertently. And I know I've talked to the department about a range, you know, plus or minus a half, maybe plus or minus nothing, as they do the technical work to get all these changes to happen, to see what the modeling really happens. We've sat through in the disability side and the community services where they were at one point had a plus or minus five, which would have ruined them all. And it took 2 years to haggle with the department to get them to agree that that was something to worry about. And so I'm just telling you, Madam Chair, for all our interests, that we can avoid the harm on a collaborative basis. So I think we should do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly appreciate hearing from these really important institutions that we have in Minnesota and our very important specialized facilities that can take care of some of these really special patients who can't get this kind of care in other places. But I just sort of want to, as Representative Abler has said, I think none of us wants to put any of our institutions in jeopardy, that's for sure. But I just kind of want to flag for you going forward, maybe it's a question, but maybe it's more than we can really deal with in this committee. But you mentioned training, the training that you do of residents, and I know that's critically important, often underfunded. You mentioned research that is done. But when we're talking about Medicaid rates, I don't think that at the end of the day our Medicaid rates should make up for the training piece or the research piece. And so I'm actually kind of curious. I really want more information about how much, what you receive in funding for the training that you do and what you receive or how your research is funded. And that's far more than we can really do today. But just to kind of flag for you that I just think that this is a big issue across the state. And, of course, my district has the Mayo Clinic main campus, mm-hmm. which trains about half the residents in the state and doesn't really get paid for that. And I think that that's something Representative Huntley's been a huge issue for him and really should be a huge issue for all of us to make sure that we are appropriately funding the training that is important for the entire state and really does serve the entire state. But I think we might be confusing the issues a little bit here, and I'm just kind of letting you know that in the future, if I have the opportunity, I'm going to be really wanting to sort of separate these pieces out so that we can make sure not only that we're funding appropriately those things that need to be funded, but that it's fair across the state and that what we're paying for when we're talking about our rates is the care that our patients are getting and that we're not paying for research that a facility is doing out of that funding and so on, because I know this is all very complicated. But there are different funding streams available for different pieces. And, when we have these very limited dollars, I want to make sure that we're allocating them appropriately, of course, as we all do. And so just to let you know that for the future. And if you could just comment right now, if you have the information on the training that you do, whether you get Merck money for that and what portion of your cost for that is covered by that Merck funding or federal funding.
Sorry. Ms. Wilson. Madam Chair, yeah, thank you very much for the question. I think that our interests are aligned and we share that commitment with the state to the training and education. My comments here were specifically today predominantly around the omnibus bill fixing the Medicaid exemption, which is really used for the clinical care of our children. And we do receive separate Merck funding for our graduate medical education. We obviously are training physicians. We're also training pharmacists, nurses, et cetera. And there are different funding sources for those pieces. I commented on those, the research and education. We do think about it the tripartite, if you will, but the funding in the Medicaid goes to the clinical care of our patients.
Thank you. Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you very much for your testimony. And Melinda. And then we have Ann and Henry next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. I know, and you're hearing this morning, and you've been hearing the incredibly hard choices this committee faces, it seems, almost every year, and how to hear a lot of very good ideas and good requests and how to balance that with the money that's available, and it's a very tough choice. And I want to thank you, actually, for making a commitment in including the personal needs allowance for spousal maintenance cases into the omnibus bill. This is one of those bills that for the families who are in this situation, this is a huge relief to them. Knowing that care is going to be available and continue to be available for them without having that disruption for some of our facilities who are operating on the margins and are now, some of them, trying to do the right thing and eat these costs. This is really going to be a game changer for some of those families. So it's a small fiscal note. It's a small population, but this is one of those bills where it really does make a huge impact on folks and is a very strategic investment. So I just want to thank the committee for recognizing that and Representative Loeffler especially for bringing it forward. But thank you. I know you have a lot of tough choices, and we're very appreciative of being included in the omnibus bill. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Don't see any questions, so thank you. So Ann Henry, Minnesota Disability Law Center, and then Roberta Ophium. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yep.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We have two areas of concern with the bill that we wanted to raise today. First of all, in Article 4, which is the new PCA program you've heard about called Community First Services and Supports, we have worked on amendments for most of our concerns with DHS, and we learned this morning that they will be put forward tomorrow, so that's good. However, our most important amendment is not among them, and that involves removing the restrictive definition of dependency, which works to discriminate mainly against persons with mental illnesses, brain injuries, and intellectual developmental disabilities who don't have physical disabilities. This was part of cuts, you may remember, from 2009. We are, at this point, hopeful still. It has some fiscal issues, and as far as we can tell, it really needs to be addressed likely by the commissioner and likely the governor's office. And if not, we think, unfortunately, this many, many good changes people have been waiting a long time for will be at least delayed quite a bit. But the second area that we have concerns with is in Article 5. And that mainly deals with a new Chapter 245D, which licenses home and community waiver services. And there are many positive changes there, especially that the mental health community brought forward. We're in strong support of those. However, we have concerns about a plan reflected in this article that will remove very clear prohibitions against restrictive practices such as mechanical restraint and seclusion that were only adopted last year and move them into a rule which is yet undeveloped and unpromulgated. We think at least the repealer here, which is a future repealer when this rule is developed, should be removed because it's going to lead to all kinds of confusion and ambiguity. Providers, lead agencies, and certainly the participants and their families are getting information and getting trained about these new requirements, which we strongly support. And then somebody's going to say, well, they're going to be repealed. People are not going to understand the plan and think, oh, maybe these are just temporary. We don't have to bother anyway. And we certainly don't want that. We are in strong support of positive behavior practices and evidence-based. We know that DHS thinks they have to do this because of the Jensen settlement in the Mito case. But with me today is Roberta Ophium, and she's very involved and will explain why we don't think that's the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ophium.
Yes, I'm Roberta Ophium, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I'm also serving in a role as consultant to the court monitor in the Jensen settlement agreement. And I know that DHS believes that this is required because of the plaintiff's counsel and some of the requests that he has made, but I think there's a gross misinterpretation. I can assure you that this language, or at least the realization of what this language would do, has not been thoroughly vetted by the plaintiff's counsel. I only found out Tuesday night that this repealer was in there. So it's a repealer of strong protections on the theory of a future rule which applied only in the past to people with developmental disabilities, whereas 245D covers all disability individuals on waivers. So I think that we're very concerned that this removes protection, puts the repealer on autopilot when we have no clue what the rule is going to say. So I've been trying to get a hold of the Plaintiff's Counsel and the Court Monitor. They're both tied up in trials, and so I haven't been able to reach them. I think the department thinks they showed this to us. If they did, it certainly wasn't made clear that it was removing all the provisions of the restraint. And Rule 40 was in there because it used to contain do positive things, and then if all else fails, you can write a Rule 40 for implementation of a programmatic use of restraints. Clearly, we wanted to end the practices of restraints. It calls for the modernization of Rule 40, but not because of the restraints, but because of its emphasis and protections on positive behavioral supports. I do not believe that there is an expectation. Otherwise, we are just putting in, back in the rule, well, here's what you should do, but here's when you can use a restraint. That led to so much confusion that I don't believe that the repealer is appropriate, at least not until we see the rule.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any comment? I think we have some things to think about between now and tomorrow, and hopefully we can talk to the department and they'll come forward.
They've indicated that they would support removing the repealer, but that was just this morning.
Okay. Well, I think we can look forward to hearing from them and members. You know, you might, if you have continuing questions based on the testimony you just heard, you might want to talk with the department as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Bruce Nelson, followed by Linda Gauboy. Lyndon Gauboy. Mr. Nelson.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Bruce Nelson from ARM. We are an organization, association of providers for people with disabilities and the disability waivers and ICFDD. I was going to acknowledge three people among you all, and they're not here, but wanted to voice our appreciation to all of you and to the chairman of the committee for dedicating so much of the target that you had to work with to home and community-based services, to people with disabilities and older adults, to their caregivers, and to the providers who employ them and need stability. We deeply appreciate that. I did want to recognize Chairman Huntley, who was in the 5% campaign, was there from day one in the launch of the campaign up in Duluth on August 13th. Recognize Representative Newton and thank him for his leadership and guidance through this effort. And recognize Representative Abler for his leadership over the years and helping us to get where we are today. Obviously, we hope that as the session develops, there can be further developments that may allow the House of Representatives to fund a full 5% increase. But that said, folks at ARM and the people who work for our members and who receive services, I thank you. I'm very grateful for what the committee is doing in regards to home and community-based services and a rate increase.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And we do have a comment or a question from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Nelson. Mr. Nelson, you know, I know that the needs are great. And obviously, the needs are great in health and human services generally, and we're obviously, just like we always do, we're struggling with the fact that we're not able to meet all needs. And I wonder if you could just tell us really quickly, maybe you're not the right person to ask, but I hope you are, where that 5% came from. Why 5%? You know, is that, and I know that when you land on a round number like that, it's always a little bit arbitrary, but could you just explain that to us, where that number comes from?
Well, Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, it is a bit arbitrary. We wanted to find a number that we could ask for that was reasonable, that, as it turns out, is fundable with the state's fiscal condition, that would make up for so many years of cuts and some cuts that didn't materialize, and you know, a net increase over the last 10 years of, you know, that lagged way, way behind inflation. So we thought that was a realistic number. And honestly, we looked at what happened last year with nursing homes, and looked at what happened to home and community-based services. Nursing homes received a 5%, and home and community-based services are 1% in that even has not yet gone into effect. And part of our concern with that is our folks, or people who provide home and community-based services, often compete for the same people, caregivers, and it's important as we move forward that we all move forward together, so that there isn't that kind of competition, an unfair competition among service providers for caregivers, that people can who want to do this kind of work can make choices between a nursing home work or home and community-based services work.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Nelson. So is there data showing what it would take to make the salaries equivalent then between people who work in nursing homes and people who work in home and community-based? Because, frankly, I'm getting emails now saying we need to raise the nursing home rates too. And I also kind of wonder, you know, I know much has been made of the 5%, you know, that number, it's got to be that number. And I get that we're way behind, even with 5%. You know, let's make no mistake. Everybody in this committee knows that even with the 5% nursing homes got, and even with the home and community-based got 5%, we're still way behind at underpaying these people. We all get that. But we did find 1% in last year's budget, and so if we did 5% here this year for home and community-based, you're actually ahead of the nursing homes for the biennium, because it really comes to 6. So I'm just wondering, I get your point about people being able to move between and not having one be better than the other, but does that do that? Is there some data that shows what that point is, where there's some equivalency?
Madam Mr. Nelson, quickly, if you could address
Madam
that.
Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm not aware of data that would precisely get at what you're trying to do. When you look at home and community-based services, at the waivers, for example, some of the waivers came into being and rates were set 20 years ago. And the only changes in those rates have been legislated. And as a result, there is disparity among the waivers and what folks are able to pay, and much less being able to compare that. And you know, I don't want to be misunderstood that we're saying that nursing homes didn't deserve what they get, that their staff are way underpaid as well. And we're not competing with them. We think we should move on together. But that said, we can, too, look at what was done last year in terms of appropriations out into the tails, into the next biennium. And I think if you look at that a 5% request for home and community-based services, when you look at the totality of services for older adults and people with disabilities, you'll find that 5% is reasonable, absolutely reasonable in that context.
Thank you for that. And I think Representative Liebling has said this too. There's absolutely not a person at this table that doesn't argue that all folks working in long-term care, whether it be nursing homes or long-term care facilities, deserve a good wage, and we're doing our best to provide that over this biennium as money is available, and balancing that with the needs in the state. But I do have, of course, a counterpoint wanting to be made over here, I think, with Representative Zerwas, and then I think we'd like to move on to the list.
I won't belabor it. I know we have a long list, Madam Chair, and I guess I'll just make the point that The 5% campaign is the 5% campaign. It's never been the 4% campaign. It's never been the 3% campaign. It's never been the 4.5% campaign. I won't stick to even just whole numbers. It's the 5% campaign. And the reality is, we're leaving $194 million on the bottom line in the budget. There's $16 million to buy back the other percent to make it the 5%. So, I know the targets make it impossible. I know that was a decision by leadership. And I think as a body, we should, I mean, it's on the register. It's ready for a vote. I think we should pull it. And we should vote on it. We should force leadership to react. We should force the governor to react. We should force the Senate to react. It would pass the floor of the House. I can't think of that many people that would vote against it. The money's there. They're leaving $194 million on the bottom line. It costs $16 million for the 1% more that we need to make a 5% campaign a 5% campaign. Let's do it.
Thank you, Representative Zerwesson. I'm just going to balance this because this has been kind of a political football here over the last few weeks. And Representative Abler, I don't want to cut you off for making your comment, but we all signed on that bill. I think everyone on the committee did. We're all supportive of giving everything we can, but in doing what you're saying, it means that we give up our entire budget and all the other things and all the other bills that are brought before this committee and that many that didn't even get hearings this year we're saying no to. So I just want to remind folks it's all about balance, and this committee is doing its best to balance the needs of
the
whole state.
It's the targets. I mean, let's have an honest discussion. It's the targets.
We have been given our targets, and we're in this committee doing the best we can to put a product forward that balances the needs in all those areas. And I'm going to let Representative Abler talk because I don't want to be accused of not letting everyone speak that has something to say. But this issue isn't going to be, we can debate it, and that's fine, we're doing that, but we have 9 or 10 other people that want to talk about other issues about this bill, and so I don't want to use the whole time we have today to debate this issue, but please, Representative Abler, have your...
Well, I just wanted to mention the effect of the minimum wage on this group, and so we took care of the nursing homes in the bill, I appreciate that, and just to remind people that other issue is outstanding. I didn't even go to the rest of it, Madam Chair, I'm done, thanks.
Thank you, and just remind everyone our target is $75 million. Whether we like it or not, that's what this committee has to deal with. And so I'd like to move on to Lyndon Gauboy, if we could. Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson, for your
Thank
comments.
You, Madam Chair.
And then Sue Abderholden is next on the list.
My name is Lyndon Gauboy. I'd like to talk about, I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. Briefly, there's an amendment that will be presented today that will take care of one, just one of the many, many severe deficiencies in this bill. And that amendment will be to move up the implementation date of the repeal of the family cap. I just want to remind you, so when it comes up, that the family cap makes it so that the welfare grant did not increase when a baby was born into the family. That we understand there's money in the TANF bottom line to cover the moving up this implementation date. Speaking of bottom lines, the bottom line about the family cap is it's simply undoing a cut. Instead of a family who's affected by this family cap living in super extreme, more than 50% below the poverty, extreme poverty, instead of being in super extreme poverty, it moves that family up to extreme poverty, still 65% below the poverty level. And to us, that is, given where we came into this session with a surplus, knowing that the welfare grants have not been increased for 28 years, knowing that the cost of living has more than doubled in 28 years, this was the year with the surplus to increase those grants at least. You know, the cost of living has doubled since 1986. There's a lot more that could have been done. We're very happy that this amendment will be offered, but to us it's just undoing a cut. It's not doing what needs to be done, which is increasing the grants across the board. I know that gets into the larger discussion you didn't want to have. I know it has to deal with the will of the other bodies in this capital, but to me, there has been a serious, serious misdeed that has happened this session. And that's all I'm going to say for now. Please support the amendment to undo the cut that passed, to undo the family cap. We would hope that if more money is found, that the grants can be increased through other mechanisms, like the bill that moves up the implementation date of the housing allowance. TANF money should go to TANF families. This is the year it could have been done. This is the year general fund money could have been used to backfill that money that has been taken from poor families year after year after year for 28 years. So shame on you. Do the right thing tomorrow.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, we'll move on to Sue Abderholden, followed by Bethany Snyder and Heidi Holz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Last year at this time, I was actually thanking you for making huge investments in the children's mental health system, and I want to thank you again for that. In today's bill, I want to thank you for including the funding for the civil commitment training. As you know, this is very important that we make sure that all players who use that act, including attorneys, judges, social workers, psychiatrists, that everybody really understands how it's supposed to be used. I will say that we are appreciative that the department made many of the changes on the 245D section to make sure that we're actually being more responsive to people with mental illnesses. Now, and I want to remind you that I did thank you earlier. I am disappointed that a couple of things didn't get in, and I just want to mention them. One is the expansion of the crisis teams. We just know that early intervention is really important. If we can get out there multiple times and try to engage people in treatment, we don't have to use commitment, and we can avoid hospitalizations. I wish we'd been able to restore the money that was taken from the adult mental health system last year to fix our armed services and to target that money for supportive housing, because we know how important that is. I think you all know and are pretty aware of the closure of our mental health center up in Region 7E. We also are looking at a closure of another ERTS facility now in Wilmer. We have a very precarious, very fragile mental health system. I think that last year you thought that you increased funding to mental health services, but in the law you actually just said mental health services, and that was going to go into effect in August, and we still don't know which mental health services those are, and so that makes it really difficult for our providers to know if they're going to get an increase or not on August 1st. Ann Henry had mentioned earlier about using the word constant in the community, our new PCA program, that will really be detrimental to people with mental illnesses, and we know that, frankly, we need all the support we can get for our folks who have the most serious illnesses to live well in the community. Lastly, I want to mention non-emergency medical transportation. I'm kind of reminded of the Rolling Stones song, you know, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometime, you might get what you need. We need this language. I really don't want to go back, to do this. Providers, you have to remember these providers actually got a rate cut that has not been restored. It's very difficult for these small businesses. Also, I want to mention, you know, that one of the new modes was protected transport, which we would have been able to actually provide dignity in transport for people with a serious mental illness. We understand you can't do the full rate increase, you know, restoration, but a tiny bit, some of the language I think would be really helpful. As the chair knows all too well, it was very hard to pull this together, and we did it, and I'd hate to lose that. Again, I want to thank you for your support. Maybe it's Pharrell Williams, you know, happy song or something. We hope that next year we can come back and really do some really big changes to the mental health system. We did the kids last year. It's been since 2007 that we've really looked at really reinvesting in our mental health system. But I do thank you for what you were able to do today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions or comments? Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Bethany Snyder and Heidi Holz, followed by Mary Krinke. Holstey, I'm sorry.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bethany Snyder from Aging Services of Minnesota, and Ms. Holstey and I represent the Long-Term Care Imperative. Our members include both nursing homes and providers of primarily elderly waiver services, but we also represent some providers who accept other Medicaid waivers, including CADI clients. The Long-Term Care Imperative is a proud supporter of the 5% campaign. We've already heard from some of our partner organizations. To that end, we thank you for the 4% increase to home and community services. We know that your budget target was insufficient to accommodate the full 5%, as you already talked about. However, we will continue to work with you and your leadership to provide a target that can fully fund this 5% campaign. 1% of the proposed funding increase to home and community services is tied to quality improvement and mirrors the governor's proposal. The long-term care imperative supports quality measures for care delivery, and we support the flexible approach in this bill, and thank you for that. We look forward to working with the House, Senate, and governor to ensure that we receive the full 5% that we've been asking for waivered service providers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Heidi Holste with Care Providers in Minnesota, and I also represent the Long-Term Care Imperative. So the first message this morning on the nursing facility side is thank you very much for including the funding and the language for the impacts of the anticipated increase in minimum wage. That is very helpful for some of our nursing facilities across the state, so very much appreciated. If the proposed increase comes out with indexing, this proposal that's included in this bill does not account for that indexing in the future. And so we look forward to continuing that conversation in the years to come. I just want to make a note, as Carrie Thurlow testified to this committee in the past, this is not necessarily a popular message. However, our nursing facilities did receive on average a 5% increase last session, and that is very much appreciated. There is nothing across the board included in this bill, and that is the emails that Representative Liebling referenced, you know, are coming from our nursing facilities. It's our understanding that there may be an amendment offered to this bill that would provide for a study of how nursing homes are funded in the future, and we would very much support something like that. Have the legislature as well as the unions and the providers sit down at the table together to try to figure out how we can have a sustainable system. We are $34 a day below the actual cost of our care per resident per day, and you know, I heard one of our business partners recently who helps nursing homes with their financing said, a nursing facility administrator does not wake up today and say, we're going to close. It takes on average 10 years for a nursing facility to close. They close beds, they close wings, they change their staffing levels. If they have foundation money, they access that. And so nursing facilities are in the process of making some significant changes. And with our rate equalization law, we just have nowhere to make that up. So appreciate your time this morning. And hopefully there will be a study that does end up getting included. If not this year, we look forward to that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments, members? Okay. Thank you very much. Mary Krinke and then Sam Walseth.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I know you all have heard a great deal in the various committees about this new hospital inpatient payment mechanism that is taking place, and I just want to provide a couple different comments from those that were already provided from a few of our members this morning already. This is a complex piece of legislation. As you all have heard, we will be implementing the new ICD-10 starting October 1. The state is indeed moving forward with a new grouper, which will then categorize those different new codes. It's also moving forward with the budget neutral rebasing. And there's various repealers in this legislation as well. So it is a complicated and sort of messy piece of legislation. I will say for the record that we have been working very, very closely with the Department of Human Services. Our finance people, we spent about 3 hours over there yesterday. They are working hard to try to get some amendments ready, hopefully by the 3 o'clock deadline today. I don't want to speak for the department, but they are working hard on those amendments. I also know that in that language, they are likely to have some type of payment band where no hospital would lose or gain more than 5% for the first couple years. Also, they are pulling out some services that we know this committee values very, very much. Pediatrics is number one on the list. Mental health was number two. Trauma was number three. So they are pulling out some specific services that they then will be able to add some additional resources to should the new coding system have a negative impact on those services. But I do think it's important to just point out one thing with this new grouper, and this is kind of all new to me too, but under the new grouper, there's going to be four categories that are going to, you're going to be able to bill to. There's going to be a mild, a moderate, a major, and a severe. And why that is important, because I think our pediatric hospitals, as well as our trauma hospitals, are probably going to be coding to those more severe codes, the major or severe. So they're likely to be compensated for some of their more expensive services. I can't guarantee to you today that everything's going to be perfect with this new system, but I do know that the department is working to address some of those concerns. I would be remiss if I didn't go on the record and say some of this problem could be easily addressed with the addition of new resources, because raising the boat for all hospitals here would help in this process. So I know that the target was set very low, but the problem with budget neutral rebasing is that you are forcing there to be losers when we update the rates. And these rates are based on 2002 costs minus 26%. So 2002 costs minus 26%. So what the department is doing is moving to 2012 costs, but keeping it budget neutral. So this process will actually add fairness. And I know that that's a difficult concept. Fairness is sometimes in the eyes of the beholder, but it will update our payments to 2012 costs instead of being based on 2002 costs. So I know that we're trying to mitigate the impact of this, and we appreciate everything that the department is doing, and I'll be around to answer questions. We'll get through this, folks, but the addition of a few resources could help rise the boats of some of those that are at the bottom. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, do you have comments or questions? Okay. So Mr. Walseth is next, followed by Eric Howden.
Madam Chair and members, Sam Walseth on behalf of the Sustainable Resources Center, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to healthy and energy-efficient homes. On behalf of the coalition of partner organizations who've been working on this initiative for some time, I want to thank you for including the Healthy Homes Grant proposal in the bill. We do have one request, and that is the bill, the Healthy Homes Grant language be expanded to include more applicants. Right now on line page 5.26, the only eligible applicant is a nonprofit organization, which actually in all self-interest would benefit my client. However, on behalf of the coalition we've been working with, we would like to see that expanded to also include community health boards and community action agencies under 256E.31, and I think an amendment is forthcoming to do that. And Madam Chair and members, just to clarify, too, in the rider section of this, this is a small step forward, $100,000 per year on line 147.20. The grant language says $100,000 in fiscal 14 and $100,000 in fiscal 15. We were just wondering if, given that by the time this bill would be signed into law, fiscal 14 would be about over, and if there is $200,000 available for the biennium, if that fiscal 14 grant is eligible to continue into fiscal 15.
Okay, yeah, Mr. Berg is not here, and so I think that's a question we can ask him either offline or tomorrow when the amendment comes forward, but I think that's worth asking.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Walseth? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And we have Eric Hauge, followed by Mary Jo George.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Eric Hauge with AFSCME Council 5. I'll be very brief and to the point. We understand, as other testifiers have mentioned, that you have some very difficult decisions to make. And indeed, this makes many worthwhile investments and items that are important to the members we represent in Minnesota. The cost of living increase in home and community-based services and funding for the Community Addiction Recovering Enterprise, albeit at a lower level than the governor had recommended. These are important items to us. But the state, as the primary safety net providers for individuals who often have nowhere else to go and are some of the hardest to serve Minnesotans, may, under this budget, have even fewer programs to turn to that are willing and able to serve them. The lack of critical salary supplements for state-operated services and MSOP, as we understand it and as the commissioner highlighted in her letter, will result in over 200 layoffs and the closure of most of the community behavioral health hospitals, the CABS program, and the intensive residential treatment services facilities. I have members here today who work in some of these exact facilities in Alexandria and Fergus Falls, and I'm sure they could attest to the difficult clients that they serve. Of course, they are concerned about their own jobs. Who wouldn't be? But this is larger than any one employee or any one facility. This is about the common good and the commitment we have made as a state to taking care of our most vulnerable citizens. I look forward to working with you over the next several weeks to find a solution so that Minnesota can continue to provide these necessary services. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Any questions, member? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate that. And Mary Jo George and Steve Larson, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with AARP. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. AARP would like to thank the committee for their investment in the home and community-based services. We think this is a very important investment. We know after survey, seniors want to live in the community, and we also know it's very cost-effective. We can serve three seniors in the community for the same amount that it costs to care for somebody in a nursing home, so we're very appreciative of that investment. However, there are a few items we would like to see folks consider. We will be bringing forward some amendments to address these. The first is the Representative Savick's spousal impoverishment bill. This allows a community spouse to convert their retirement assets into an annuity stream. At this point, we are working with the department because we do not believe the fiscal note calculated sort of the estate recovery provisions, so we think we can lower that. We're hopeful we can do that. The other has to do with the bill that Representative Fritz had, which would mitigate the cuts to the Elderly Services Program and the CADI program. We had both a no-cost and a low-cost provision in there. The one that is very low-cost that we'd like you folks to consider is increasing the appeals process from 10 to 30 days. So as people lose their services, we think this will give them more time to transition into the new programs. And then lastly, we'd like folks to consider maybe for the next biennium beginning to fund Representative Loeffler's bill that looks at addressing the income and asset standards for seniors and people with disabilities. We know with the major changes to the nursing home level of care in 2015 that many more seniors are going to have to spend down to be able to stay on a Medicaid below poverty, and we think this will threaten their ability to live in the community. So thank you for that, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much for raising those issues to the committee. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I was a little distracted. Ms. George, did you talk about the, you're probably happy with the money for the nursing homes to supplement the minimum wage thing? I thought you're probably happy about that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Abler, yes, we think that's an appropriate thing to do.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
And so, Madam Chair, and so is AARP concerned about the effect on the direct service professionals and the community services that are going to, if there's no reflection of minimum wage, effect on them? Is that also on your mind?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, to the extent I understand the question, I think our preference would be that we'd see a 5% increase to the home and community-based services as we did with the nursing homes last year. Does that get at what you were asking me?
Representative Abler?
Madam Chair, and Ms. George, you can go back to your home office and talk about it. But there's a $15 million impact or so on the home and community-based individuals. It's an undefined number, but it's still in my mind as this minimum wage thing goes forward. Mm-hmm. And so plugging the nursing home bit of it is important, and that's one niche. But they tell me if the four goes forward, I think it's worth it. It's worth about a point and a half. And so they won't get anything approaching their 5%. They'd get a 3.5 or 2 or something. Three. And so just to, maybe just want to work on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank
Madam
you
Chair, yeah, absolutely. We strongly support paying livable wages to our direct workers to care for our seniors. So we will help to work on anything we can do to support that. Thank you.
Thank you. And our last testifier on our list is Steve Larson from ARC. And then we may have about 5 minutes to just kind of open it up for others to testify or folks to ask questions or share their opinions here at the table. Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and I'm here to speak about House File 1897, and which is the State Quality Council funding bill. This bill was heard in this committee and was supported but wasn't included in the spreadsheets. We are going to be spending money on quality, but unfortunately it's going to be cleaning up things. There's $1.4 million in the budget as proposed by this committee to monitor what's happening with the Jensen court settlement. And that has some significant tails along with it. That settlement was for $3 million, so that's 1.4 plus 3. We're now paying for a special court master. We're going to pay for the Olmstead Implementation Office, and I could go on and on. So again, we're here just to share with the committee that we think we need to develop a quality framework moving forward that gives a voice to persons with disabilities if we're going to get in the front end of this. We are spending billions of dollars. Minnesota is a leader in home and community-based services, and we need to develop a system that promotes quality for persons with disabilities. And I'm just going to stop there and let Kurt Rutzen share a few comments, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair and the committee members, my name is Kurt Rutzen. I'm the past chair of Region 10, a system we need to go to. It's way, way overdue. We need to be listening to people, persons with disabilities who are not today. We are not today. The only reason the lawsuit came to a head and they did what was right was because a person with disabilities opened his or her mouth and talked and someone finally listened to him. Or we wouldn't have a clue about that Meadow case. We would just sweep that case too under the rug. And that's why we need to listen to disability people. I find that not me personally, but I people go to other people with disabilities because they listen and they care and they can relate, so they go to other people with disabilities, and that should teach us all a lesson. You and I need to listen more to these people. And we need to take it up a notch, maybe five notches, and continue to listen. I thank you all very, very much and appreciate you all more than you'll ever know. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Larson. And I just Kurt, I just have to say that it's real dismaying to me that we have to make progress by court cases, and you're absolutely right. We have to invest in a quality system that doesn't let us fall to a point that a judge has to order things, but instead we see when things are going off the track and people aren't being served respectfully, that there's a corrective mechanism, and I think you're absolutely right, that listening to the people whose lives every day are impacted in a setting in which they don't have as much control as we are lucky enough to have in our lives, have the right to and the ability to hold the system accountable and to ask for change when it's needed, and keep challenging us on this one because many of us share your frustration that we're not moving faster.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I think we have someone else who's come to the microphone. If you would like to go to the mic and state your name for the record, and then give us your brief testimony, and then members, if you have any comments or questions. Okay, and it looks like we have another one, too. Okay.
Sarah Leverins with AFSCME Council 65, and earlier in the session, I had two of our members who work at Wadena Developmental Achievement Center testify in the Senate, but given how fast things are now moving, it couldn't be arranged in the House. But I want to tell you about these two people. They work for the Wadena Developmental Achievement Center. They make $8.01 an hour. One of them is divorced. Her husband pays a small amount of child support, but between making $8 an hour and a small amount of child support, she can't afford a home to live in. She's living with her parents, and the three children are living with her parents. The other one is married to a man who has seasonal employment. I think he's in the construction industry. And when he's not working in the winter, they feed the children first. And they only eat if there's food left over. And when she testified in the Senate, she told us that she worked 96 hours a pay period, 6 days a week, and that it was, after working so hard, it was incredibly depressing for her to not be able to eat. And these are the people who are providing the services that the gentleman who spoke before me receives. And how are we going to provide good services if we pay people $8 an hour and they can't afford to eat? Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your testimony. And I think we have one more that failed to be on my list. Mike Mahoney.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members. I apologize, I wasn't on the list, but I appreciate just a minute of your time. My name is Michael Mahoney. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy for Essentia Health. And I'm here specifically on behalf of St. Mary's Medical Center located in Duluth, Minnesota. I'm going to kind of go back in time a little bit here for the conversation that had to do more with children's hospitals and pediatric care. And so I also want to thank, although he's not present right now, Representative Tom Huntley for all his efforts on our behalf in the past as well. Within St. Mary's Medical Center, we have been dedicating significant square footage to an internal facility. Although it's not freestanding, it's our children's hospital north of the Twin Cities. We recently underwent a renovation in excess of $5 million to upgrade our neonatal intensive care unit, which currently holds 20 beds. We have a general pediatric unit of 18 beds and a pediatric intensive care unit of another 6 beds. And so I would challenge this committee in the discussions over where monies are directed toward hospitals or specifically children's hospitals to perhaps change that discussion from a facility-specific discussion to a patient-centered one. And that being perhaps have a conversation around having those dollars flow wherever those children decide to receive their care. And so with that, I'm happy to stand for questions and just mindful of the minimal time the committee has.
Thank you very much for that. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad Mr. Mahoney can come. And I think this is something we should consider, and I wanted to at least let him say something. And I do have a question for the department, if they could, about their letter. So I know we have no time, so at least he got to say
it. We have 2 minutes, Representative Abler.
Could Ms. Berry come down and answer some questions about her letter?
Ms. Berry? Or someone else?
Yeah. And Madam Chair, just as she's coming, they were specific on the amount of FTEs that would be lost. That was my question from yesterday, how many FTEs, and it's over 200 in some very sensitive programs. And then it wasn't clear how many would be lost if the department, if they didn't cover the $3 million, I don't think. And so maybe if you can just comment on what happens if the House bill goes forward and becomes law.
Ms. Berry.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Berry, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Representative Abler, yes, what you've pointed out in the letter from the commissioner is an accurate accounting of what happens if we don't get the sentence, if we don't get the salary supplement that was included in the governor's budget. We have already eaten almost $9 million in salary adjustment costs. As you know, those state contracts are bargained on a statewide basis. We're responsible for providing them for all employees, whether we get the resources to do it or not. We have done so across the department. Continuing to do so, though, really does eat into these programs. So you are right. Over 200 employees would be immediately impacted. At the same time, we would have to start a process of closing down a number of our community behavioral health hospitals and the child and adolescent behavioral services and our ERTS programs. They are the only other general fund programs. The rest of our programs are either in enterprise funds or in special revenue funds and not available to cover costs associated with these programs. So we could easily say we would double the number of people that we would have to lay off or by these provisions.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and I know the time's limited, but I'm happy, well, not happy, I'm actually really sad to have this part of the proposal. I think that you really didn't mean this, and so I hope that as this goes forward that this provision can be remedied. This was part of the contract that was voted on just a couple days ago, and I voted yes, and I think all of you did, and some people on our side did, and so I think if they would have known that the money was going to have to come out of their own resources, they would have made a different contract or could have soft landed these programs. I think they expected the money would be there, and I hope that we can do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are at the end of our committee time. If you want to continue meetings. Oh, yes, we do have to pass the minutes. So, Representative Loeffler, have you perused the minutes?
Madam Chair, I would be glad to move the minutes of
March 24th.
March 24th. Thank you.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any nays? Thank you. So, unless we want to convene this evening for further questioning, I see heads nodding no. We have listened to all of our testifiers in the amount of time that we had. We've had a little bit of discussion. I assume we'll have more when we reconvene to mark up the bill tomorrow. So tomorrow evening at the regular time, and then we'll go into the evening if we need to. So watch your emails, but we'll see you tomorrow at our regular time. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.